Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and discuss the growth and power of the four largest banks, who, according to a study released yesterday, could add at least another trillion to their $7.7 trillion in assets before reaching limits imposed by the Obama administration. Simon Johnson, the former chief economist at the IMF, joins us to explain how the banks won and banking reform lost. Then we'll discuss the possibility of democracy in the Arab world following the overthrow of the Tunisian dictator. John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus, joins us to assess whether Washington fears a genuine democratic revolution in the Arab world. Then finally, we'll talk with Ted Fishman, author of Shock of Grey, about the greying of America and how policies that pit old against young could be reformed to have older workers retire earlier to free up jobs for younger workers, the opposite of what is happening in the United States, where older workers are expected to work longer and retire later with less. So stay tuned. Let's begin by assessing the current status of Too Big to Fail. I'm speaking with Simon Johnson, who is the Ronald A. Kurtz Professor of Entrepreneurship at MIT Sloan School of Management and author with James Quack of 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover and the Next Financial Meltdown, just out in paperback. He was the IMF's chief economist. He's also co-founder of BaselineScenario.com and an economic advisor to the CBO. He has an article out on Bloomberg.com titled, City Weekend Shows Too Big to Fail Endures. Thank you for joining us on Background Briefing, Simon Johnson.
My pleasure.
It seems that given the extraordinary concentration of wealth with these top four banks who collectively hold about $7.7 trillion in assets, and they apparently could add another trillion to that and not reach the 10% cap on financial firms' liabilities relative to the entire system. What's important, I think, for the audience to understand is that just 9 years ago, it took 15 banks to control half of the assets, and now only four banks today control half of the assets.
That's right. The financial system has become a great deal more concentrated. That happened under the boom in the early 2000s, but it also increased, the degree of concentration increased as a result of the financial crisis, particularly because some banks were allowed or even encouraged to buy other banks. So you end up with relatively fewer of them, and the ones that remain have a lot more power.
So I keep hearing very different things, Simon Johnson, about the power of these banks. On the one hand, that they're too big to fail, which appears to be the case, and that they're sort of this inexorable kind of juggernaut. But on the other hand, you keep hearing these kind of rumors, and other economists have brought them up to me in interviews, that perhaps some of them have actually failed, and that there's this huge shell game going on where all these toxic assets are being shuffled around in some alchemical way. And in fact, many of them are, while we are outraged by the bonuses and the fact that they're sitting on all this capital, as the president tried to pry some loose recently, that maybe there's a different story out there. Do you have any information on that scenario?
Well, it's hard to know the true reality because we're not allowed to see all the detailed information. And the last time there were stress tests that were made public was about 18 months ago. So that information is somewhat stale. I would say that the banks are probably at this stage solvent, the ones that remain. However, I would point out that they are making some money, not a huge amount of money, some money on the basis of essentially zero short-term interest rates. So their results should all be viewed in the light of a very loose set of policies put in place by the Federal Reserve. And as interest rates start to rise, which they will when the economy recovers properly starting this year, I would say, the banks are going to be much harder pressed. And we'll find out what happens to default rates, for example, on all the loans they're holding in their portfolios as interest rates start to go up.
But there are some economic indicators that aren't particularly good. I take it that there'll be a lot of defaults this year, perhaps even a record number. And there's now a concern in terms of local governments and state governments, municipal bonds. Is that an overstated concern?
No, I think that's a legitimate concern. The municipal bond market, meaning state and local governments, is not that large in the United States. It's a couple of dollars. So it's not as big as the mortgage market. And we don't think there's many complicated leverage bets have been made on that market, as happened with housing. So it's going to be difficult. Local finances are going to be very tough. Some states are going to be very hard-pressed. I don't think you're going to see another massive financial explosion. But there's no doubt there's a lot of consequences still to be experienced.
And there is a political dimension to this where the new Congress, with a crop of fairly conservative ideologues, they've stopped the notion of bailing out some of the states that they consider profligate, like California and Illinois. But there's also another agenda that many people have pointed out, which is that they'd like to break the power of some of these municipal employee unions.
Yeah, there's certainly going to be a struggle around those issues. And the very unfortunate fact is that for a long time, everyone around public pension plans was not being completely honest with themselves, with the pensioners, and with the taxpayers regarding the true cost of those pension plans. And now, this is not a problem unique to the public sector. We've also seen lots of deception around private pension plans in the past. But the problem is when you're promising people money 20, 30, 40 years down the road, they're willing to believe all kinds of things. And as you get closer to the dates when people are actually going to retire, you realize that the true cost of the pensions and the health care benefits become quite daunting.
But this also has the potential, I think, of a kind of class warfare, in as much as private sector workers who have seen their pensions eviscerate and their medical plans go away are being pitted against public employees who have what many people considered too generous pensions and medical coverage.
Yes, I'm sure there will be some of that. I would suggest, though, that the big distinction and the big tension is going to be much more between capital, meaning the people who benefit from the profits of firms, and labor. If you compare this recession with what happened in the early 1980s, profits have bounced back very quickly, much faster than we've ever seen in a modern recession, actually. And employment, of course, has come back much more slowly than in any recession in the post-World War II period. So the real division here is between the people who get to make the money on this rapid recovery and the bailouts, and the people who lose the jobs and are struggling in the private sector and the public sector as a result of the financial crisis and the damage done to this country by a few very large banks.
But there has been for some time, though, productivity and household income have tracked in parallel, and then they've started to diverge, and then they've diverged enormously since about 2000. And it seems pretty clear on that particular graph that capital is the beneficiary of productivity and labor is not. And that seems to be a global phenomenon, isn't it?
Well, top wage earners have also benefited. The top 1% and the top 10% have done very well in the United States over the past 10 years, 20 years, and actually 30 years. The lower end of the wage distribution did less well in the 1980s. They had a pretty good 1990s, and they did less well in the 2000s. But overall, I agree that the pattern around the world is that income distribution is becoming more unequal, certainly in countries that are, on average, as prosperous and as highly productive as the United States.
And Simon Johnson, does that mean that we're sort of heading into what Adam Smith predicted, a world where capital transcends nationality, that we have a kind of new global financial elite?
Oh, I think we moved into that world quite a long time ago. I think that's the world that the U.S. created after World War II. And that's a world, of course, that has shared benefits to a remarkable and unprecedented degree around the world. But it's a world that brings a lot of complications, a lot of difficulties, and it's not a stable world. The capital flowing around the world is not maturing, it's not settling down, it's not stabilizing. It's not stabilizing in the United States, let alone Brazil, China, Russia, India, you name it, in terms of other countries and other parts of this capital flows. And this is where a big part of our danger lies as we move ahead, both in terms of how we run our own policies at a big, grand macroeconomic level, but also in terms of what we let the banks do. If you let a few banks in any country get out of proportion, get overly powerful, they'll blow themselves up. And look at Europe. Europe's got terrible consequences in Ireland, that the country's basically been bankrupted by the profligacy of three big banks and the real estate developers and the politicians who they were all in bed with.
It seems, as Simon Johnson, you can't head toward a plutonomy on the one hand and revive the middle class on the other. And do you think at some point there's got to be, I'm not talking about revolution, but at least a choice here or some refocusing or some admission about where we are, like in AA, you know, the 12 steps program?
I would like to think so. But of course, the last time we saw this kind of development in the income distribution in the United States was at the end of the 19th century. And there was a progressive movement. There was a lot of pushback. There was a rising but vulnerable middle class that found a voice and figured out how to get people elected that wanted to change the system. And they did change the system over 20 years or so. But there's no sign of that movement now. The voices that speak up are from very different parts of the political spectrum. They don't want that same sort of moderate change and reform. They don't want measures that, that will reduce income inequality. So, yes, I agree that we should see change in that direction, but there's no sign of it yet on the horizon.
Again, I'm speaking with Simon Johnson, the author of 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover, and The Next Financial Meltdown. And Simon Johnson's among a group of finance experts who've advocated the breakup of the nation's largest lenders, the opposite of which is happening, according to a report just released yesterday. And he's joined by a number of Federal Reserve bankers, Thomas Hoenig, James Bullard and Richard Fisher. And also you could add Paul Volcker to that in terms of a voice of gravitas here. Why collectively don't voices like yours and Volcker's, who's basically said the only real financial innovation has been the ATM, we see that the financial service industry, as it's called, I'm not sure what service means, but it is growing. Our industrial base has been eviscerated and exported. We have what looks like what could be permanent unemployment. It seems that there's been these tectonic shifts and we're all sort of reeling from it.
That's right. There are some very disturbing developments that really brought us to this point. I would emphasize, though, in terms of the people who are speaking out against this, these are voices from the left and from the middle and from the right. So Gene Farmer from the University of Chicago, John Cochran from the University of Chicago, they are just as adamant that the current system with these massive so-called too-big-to-fail banks is out of control. They're just as adamant as anybody from the left, or Joe Stiglitz, for example, from Columbia mm-hmm. University. So it's very important that people have it clear that there's agreement on right and left that the financial system needs to be fixed. There is, unfortunately, no agreement or no movement in the political class, the people who actually get themselves elected to Washington. Those people are not inclined to take on this problem right now.
Well, aren't they compromised, though, by campaign donations from Wall Street? And I haven't seen anybody on Capitol Hill really ask these broader questions about how long the health of our economy can last if so much of the economy in terms of the financial sector seems to be about extracting wealth and not creating wealth. And now they've computerized these systems where you've got all this trading happening in ways that shut out just about anybody except these Nobel math laureates.
Yeah, high-speed trading is a new and I think quite dangerous development. There's a lot of black boxes in that system that nobody really understands how they work and how they interact with each other. Look, the entire system has become more unfair. It's become more unfair. It's become more dysfunctional. It needs to be reined in. Particularly, the power of the largest banks needs to be limited, and they need to be much more equity financed. The days when they can pile a lot of debt onto a very thin layer of equity, those days should be over. But unfortunately, they're not. And this is about the campaign contributions. It's about a revolving door between Wall Street and Washington. And it's about the ideology of finance that became very strong in the past 20 years. That ideology needs to be challenged. It's cracking. There's a lot of people from right and left, very smart people who are helping it to crack. But we need to work harder on that.
Well, some people have made the, I think Felix Salmon among them, have made this distinction between Wall Street that sort of have often been described as kind of, in the biblical sense, of money changers, vis-a-vis, say, Silicon Valley, where you have a company like Apple that's doing very well, that actually produces innovative products that people want. But on the other hand, if you look at the recent Goldman Sachs deal with Facebook, it seems to indicate to me something that you just said, which is that there's a lack of fairness. Because if all of these successful companies decide to stay private and to deal with just hedge funds and private equity groups, and by the time they have to do their IPOs, all of the insiders have all made tons and tons of money, and then the rest of the suckers on Wall Street are left with the crumbs.
Yes, that's unfortunately would not be a big surprise. The way in which the capital markets are working seem increasingly rigged towards relatively few people. And of course, Goldman Sachs got themselves into hot water with the SEC and now it seems with their clients by having to pull back from the idea they would manage a quasi-private offering of Facebook shares. Within the United States, that's not allowed. So they had to shift to overseas clients. I don't think it's going to change their means or mode of operating at all. You'll see more of the same in and around the social networking space.
Well, in terms of kind of culture, there was a movie that was out. I don't know whether you saw the one by Michael Moore, Capitalism, A Love Story, there was a memo from Citibank that was featured in the documentary that suggested a kind of aggressive kind of elitism that, you know, we could get by with a plutonomy that where the very wealthy minority could turn enough money over to make up for the lack of consumption from the extinct middle class and all of those notions. And I'm just wondering, when we hear just a report yesterday from NBC News that JP Morgan's now had to admit that it's overcharged more than 4,000 active duty military personnel on their home loans and foreclosed in errors on a number of them. These are people that serve overseas. Apparently there's a federal law that prevented that, but that was apparently not observed. The Servicemen's Civil Relief Act that allowed servicemen abroad to get reduced interest rates at 6%. And then prior to that, Prudential was caught basically denying interest benefits to widows and orphans of soldiers that were killed in terms of the death benefits that the Congress had mandated. This is a long-winded way to suggest, is there a culture there of that, you know, there's them and us? And that they don't seem particularly grateful for the fact that the poor beleaguered taxpayer bailed them out.
Oh, they're not grateful at all. They think it was their due, and they don't feel that they should behave any differently going forward. Look, you're right. There's a culture in some parts of Wall Street. I don't put everybody in this category, but unfortunately, the institutions you named are big and powerful and very much have this kind of culture at the top. And that culture is a culture of disrespect. It's a culture where the customers are not important people to them. They're just numbers. And they're numbers that can be mistreated as and when they see fit.
So how does the Main Street reassert itself if there's this dichotomy between Main Street and Wall Street?
You need some politicians who are willing to take a stand. And right now there's a few of them, but only very few. Not many politicians can stand up to the money from Wall Street and the power of the lobbyists there. There needs to be a broader political movement that really taps into these issues, that understands the substance and is willing to take it on. So it's very early days, and it takes us a long time before we'll see real change on these issues.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Simon Johnson.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Simon Johnson, author, with James Quack of 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover and the Next Financial Meltdown, which has just come out in paperback. He's the former chief economist for the IMF, and he has an article out on Bloomberg.com titled City Weekend Shows Too Big to Fail Endures. We'll take a short break, and then we'll come back and hear from John Pfeffer about whether or not there will be democracy in the Arab world. And welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm joined by John Pfeffer, who is the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Previously, he worked as the associate editor of World Policy Journal and has been an international affairs representative in Eastern Europe and East Asia for the American Friends Service Committee. His books include Power Trip, U.S. Unilateralism and Global Strategy After September 11 and Living in Hope, People Challenging Globalization. His new article, Arab Democracy Now, appears on the Huffington Post. Thank you for joining us, John Pfeffer.
Thanks for having me on your show.
And I take it you're finishing a book on Islamophobia.
I am, just as we speak.
Well, I say at this moment, there's a little Islamo, what would you say?
Islamophilia.
Philia, yes, on the streets of Tunis. And how long is that going to last, do you think? Is it? It's a bit of an obscenity that it took 23 years for the U.S. and the French and the rest of the West to wake up to the fact that their guy in Tunis was a kleptocrat and a dictator. And Hillary Clinton did, just by a couple of days, preempt the downfall of this guy in Qatar by calling for more democracy in the Arab world. But I guess the real issue is, what kind of credibility does the U.S. have in terms of its calls for democracy in the Arab world?
Not a great deal, unfortunately. I mean, we still are propping up other dictators in the Arab world. Certainly Egypt is number one on the list. We also have a pretty cozy relationship with Saudi Arabia. And, you know, we justify those relationships for various, you know, means. You know, we need the oil from Saudi Arabia. We are still sort of rewarding Egypt for having had at one point a good relationship with Israel. But nevertheless, you know, there have been calls for democracy in those countries for quite some time. and we've largely ignored them. So the situation in Tunisia certainly has come about not as a result of U.S. pressure, as you've pointed out, but actually despite U.S. kind of support for the previous regime.
And I think an even more disgraceful French amorality.
Yeah, well, the French French foreign policy has been pretty abysmal all along, and it's a result of its colonial history in the region. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with the policies that France had towards its colony Algeria for over 100 years, resulting in just a terrible civil war and finally Algeria's independence. But the scars of that colonial policy still haunt Algeria today.
So at this point, where would our tradition of our diplomatic and foreign policy tradition of preferring stability over democratic change, particularly following Hillary Clinton's speech in Qatar the other day to the Arab Middle Eastern foreign ministers suggesting that that some of these countries are going to sink into the sand?
I don't think we're going to see a real sea change in U.S. foreign policy. We should remember that we've had calls in the past by U.S. governments for greater democracy. Of course, we heard it from the neoconservatives in the Bush administration, and that, of course, was a very complicated call for democracy promotion. It was focused entirely on our adversaries, not on our allies. In other words, focused on Iraq, Iran, not, for instance, on Egypt or Saudi Arabia.
Well, and that show worked out well.
And that did not work out well. And even President Obama, in his speech in Cairo, in which he basically pushed the reset button on, or he tried to push the reset button on engagement with the Muslim world, he too talked about democracy. But there, too, it didn't really translate into anything concrete in terms of what the U.S. was doing in its relationship with, let's say, Egypt for the moment, because in the last elections, we saw that the government there still manipulated the results, still ensured that the Islamist parties, which are the kind of the more potent force in the Egyptian society, would not do very well at all. And so this is a clear indication that the Obama administration continued, even after the Cairo speech, to continue the policies of its predecessors.
Again, I speak with John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies and the author of a new article, Arab Democracy Now. And in your article, of course, you point out the irony that the neocons under George W. Bush and in terms of Condoleezza Rice's being the spokesperson for some of these policies did call for greater democracy in the Middle East, but it clearly made some of the despots that we support a little uncomfortable, but it was clearly focused on Saddam Hussein. And as a result of the Iraq War and now our quagmire in Afghanistan, we have very little moral authority, I'm afraid, in that part of the world. And furthermore, of course, in getting rid of a minor dictator like Saddam Hussein, we've made the Iranian military intelligence religious dictatorship even stronger. But the argument you go on, though, to suggest that a lot of our thinking is influenced by what happened in Algeria when the FIS took over, the Islamic Salvation Front, and one of our assistant secretaries of state coined the phrase, one person, one vote, one time. So on the one hand, Hillary Clinton saying we need more democracy. And on the other hand, the foreign policy establishment is saying, well, be careful, right?
Exactly. I mean, the greatest fear, and it links kind of authoritarian regimes in the region with policymakers in Washington, the greatest fear is that Islamic forces will take over, as they threatened to in Algeria, in the Algerian elections in the late 1980s, early 1990s. The Islamic Salvation Front did much better than anybody had anticipated, but instead of kind of taking power, in fact, the military government kind of pushed them aside, conducted severe repression, A civil war resulted. Over 100,000 people were killed. And, you know, that's the scenario that the authoritarian leaders in the region kind of use with the United States. They say, hey, look, if you don't support us, look at what's going to happen. You have these Islamic fundamentalists that are breathing down our necks. But in fact, if you look very carefully at many of these Islamist forces, they're not the kind of fundamentalist al-Qaeda types that some in Washington believe them to be. There's been quite an evolution among Islamic parties in the region, such that many have been participating in elections, have even, in the case of Hezbollah, been participating in governments. This is a real sea change in kind of the attitudes of Islamist parties.
Well, a best example would be the ruling party now in Turkey, which is a very successful, in fact, Turkey in many ways is replacing the United States in terms of influence in that part of the world. But that's not to say, though, John Pfeffer, that, you know, the Algerian regime that quashed the Fis uprising, that's left more than 100,000 people dead. They're right next door. They're still in power. They're right next door to Tunisia. And it's also not to suggest that the Islamists were anything but incredibly brutal towards the end. They were quite insane in their brutality.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true.
So it's a mixed bag, and it will be very interesting to see what happens in Egypt, clearly. I mean, if indeed there are these dominoes out there that Washington fears in terms of a genuine democratic revolution, that Egypt, Jordan, Algeria, and Morocco could fall, and of course the prize ultimately would be Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I think the Algerian scenario suggests that when Islamist forces are repressed severely, then they become repressive in turn. And the savagery in Algeria during the civil war was characteristic of both sides. And I think that if you look at what happens with Hezbollah, for instance, if given a chance to participate in a ruling coalition, they behave politically. I think that kind of model is the one that we might expect to happen in Egypt, for instance, if free elections were to take place and Islamic parties were able to participate freely. Situation in Saudi Arabia, I mean, there are no political parties in Saudi Arabia. And despite the fact that Saudi Arabia kind of exports its rather severe Wahhabi theology around the world, it has cracked down very severely on any challenges from Islamist forces within Saudi Arabia. So the situation in Saudi Arabia, I think, promises to be very dire unless the regime there begins, if slowly at first perhaps, but begins some form of political liberalization.
Well, the Saudi regime, though, have essentially gotten into bed. You have this royal family that controls and owns just about everything that have made this deal with the devil in terms of the Wahhabis, and they've allowed a kind of Islamist government, not a government, they govern, but in terms of the lives of the people, they're completely controlled by the Islamists and by the strictures of the Wahhabis. So Bin Laden, of course, came out of that. And I guess he just wants to get rid of the royal family and replace the theocracy with his theocracy.
Oh, that's true. I mean, they have a slightly different take on Islam.
Right.
There's no question that Saudi Arabia as a regime is repressive and kind of justifies it through Islamic principles.
Right, but it doesn't have nowhere to go there. That's my ultimate question. Is there any way that it can, given how much it sort of sold out to the Wahhabis in terms of the social structures there? You've got a frustrated younger generation like you have throughout the entire Arab world, and they crack down on democracy by using the Wahhabis, right?
That's true. And, you know, the relationship goes back several hundred years. I mean, this is not a recent phenomenon. And we also have to remember that the British encouraged the Wahhabis back in the beginning of the 20th century as a kind of tool against the Ottomans. It was a kind of precursor of how we used the Mujahideen against the Soviet Empire. And so all along, we've kind of encouraged this relationship all the way up until FDR signing a deal with the House of Saud in order to guarantee our access to that oil, through the very close relationship between the George W. Bush administration and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia becomes an important kind of key ally in our wars against Afghanistan and Iraq. So we're talking about two levels of relationship. The relationship that goes back a couple hundred years between the House of Saud and the Wahhabi kind of philosophy, and then the relationship between Western powers and the House of Saud that basically accepts Wahhabi philosophy in exchange for access to oil, and has in the past kind of seen Wahhabi philosophy as a useful tool against other enemies, primarily the Soviet Union during the Cold War.
So, John Pfeffer, the other, I mean, apart from the Egyptian leadership, which is clearly unpopular with its people, and that the Muslim Brotherhood's are waiting in the wings, and that would be, it's difficult to know. I mean, al-Baradei is trying to make a run as somewhere in between Mubarak and the Muslim Brotherhood, but even the boneheaded Mubarak is beating up on Mohammed al-Baradei, who seems like a centrist, showing how short-sighted he is. But clearly, this would have an enormous impact on the state of Israel, would not, which is the U.S.'s main, seems its main focus in the Middle East, is on the state of Israel. And many people argue that the tail wags the dog there, that the Israelis basically tell the Americans what to do and not the other way around. But if Egypt falls to the Muslim Brotherhood, if the Jordanian king falls, and he's got a very frail situation there with a majority of Palestinians, enormous number of angry Sunni refugees from Iraq, and an artificial no economy propped up by the CIA. He introduced his father introduced some democratic reforms, and Abdullah quickly backtracked on them. So I guess this is a long-winded way of saying that if the Jordanians fall to the Muslim Brotherhood and if Egypt falls to the Muslim Brotherhood, then the two main treaties that provide Israel with security would be out the window.
Israel is not enthusiastic about democracy outside within its region, rather, or outside its borders, because it recognizes that democratic elections could, as it did in the Palestinian territories, bring in forces that it's uncomfortable with. Now, I think that, again, like Hezbollah, the Muslim Brotherhood has, evolved considerably over the years. I mean, it was at one point it supported the use of terrorism to advance its goals. It had more of a support for a kind of a caliphate vision that Al-Qaeda still holds on to. But more recently, the Brotherhood has really taken a much more kind of strong stance in favor of democratic participation in governments. Again, the outside observers, the pessimists say they're just doing that in order to seize power. They have no kind of intrinsic desire to see democracy upheld in those countries. The optimists, and I consider myself an optimist on this issue, sees real evolution in their philosophy, such that they're willing to participate in coalition governments. They're willing to kind of accept democracy and democratic structures.
Toppled a democratic government by pulling out of the coalition Beirut, in Lebanon.
That's correct. But that was a political move.
It is a political move, but it could have some serious consequences.
It could. There's no question about it. But, as Hezbollah has pointed out, in the past, it might have taken up arms. But it has acted politically. We may not be happy with the way it acted politically, but that was, an acceptable democratic maneuver. Again, I hope it doesn't lead to chaos or conflict in the country, but we should acknowledge that particular development.
But of course, they are Hezbollah are allied with Iran. Many say they're a surrogate of Iran, and Iran, of course, has gone. I mean, that is the ultimate tragedy of U.S. meddling in that region, is getting rid of the Iranian democracy back in with the toppling of Mossadegh, bringing in this dreadful Shah, who was then replaced by this theocracy that has practiced a democracy, but now they've turned on their own democracy, which was the only validity that they had. And now you have a kind of Islamo-fascist Revolutionary Guard Corps government at odds with itself and beating up its own people.
Yeah, the situation in Iran is tragic. I mean, we did have a really tremendous upswell of support for reform within the country, and not especially radical reform. I mean, the folks who supported the Green Movement, you know, were probably mainstream in terms of intellectuals, in terms of their take on Islam. They certainly supported a civilian nuclear program, for instance, for the country. But as you point out, Ahmadinejad and his supporters crack down on them. We're not tolerant of even that kind of reformist impulse. I think also the Green Movement perhaps overestimated the power that they had throughout the country. I mean, they saw that they had tremendous support in Tehran and in certain other parts of the country, but when it came down to it, they discovered that, in fact, Ahmadinejad did have considerable support. Considerable support from folks who, you know, are dependent on the government for either employment or for handouts of one sort or another. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that is support. And as they are licking their wounds now, the Green movement is kind of trying to understand how change can come within Iran if it's not going to be, say, supported by 90% of the population.
Well, I not a pretty picture. That is the truth of the matter. And on the other hand, you know, we should obviously support and encourage democracy and let the chips fall, because and unfortunately, we don't have much credibility in that. I guess at the end of the day, that's what it comes down to.
It was supporting the right of self-determination, not an imposition of our notions of democracy onto other people.
Absolutely. Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, John Pfeffer.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with John Pfeffer, who's the co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. His article, Arab Democracy Now, appears in the Huffington Post. Let's take a brief station break and then we'll return. And we're joined by Ted Fishman, author of Shock of Grey. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm speaking with Ted Fishman, the author of Shock of Grey, The Aging of the World's Population and How It Pits Young Against Old, Child Against Parent, Worker Against Boss, Company Against Rival, and Nation Against Nation. Ted Fishman is a veteran journalist, essayist, and former member and trader of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. His previous book was the international bestseller China Incorporated, or China Inc., How the Rise of the Next Superpower Challenges America and the World. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ted Fishman.
Thank you, Ian. Glad to be with you.
And your book, basically, its central argument is that aging is accelerating globalization, because as science allows us to live longer and we choose to have fewer children, then we increasingly rely on products from made by more affordable labor, shall we say, outsourced abroad.
Yeah, I mean, for me, once I started reporting the book, it just became apparent to me that, like, in all of my important relationships, especially my economic relationships, the aging of the demographic around me was informing everything. Who was I seeing in shops? Who was I seeing out of work? And so what I did was pose the question, does the changing of the age demographic in the world in some way propel globalization? And this was, you know, something that I was nervous about asking, but I had to ask it, because when I was in China reporting that first book you mentioned, China Inc., I was very puzzled by the fact that the cities were so young and the foreign capital coming in seemed to only be employing young people, while China itself is really an aging country because of the one-child policy. So it seemed to me that the world was shopping for youth, and I was curious for the reason for that, and that's what the book explores.
And one of the statistics that that you present in the book is that by 2025, there'll be 66 million Americans above the age of 65. But by the same year, 2025, in China, China will be home to one-fifth of the world's population, but home to one-fourth of all the people on the planet over 65.
Yeah, this demonstrates the power that smaller families have in changing the population profile of the country. So you age 1 year for every year, I age 1 year for every year. But countries really age, their median age gets driven up both by how long people live, but more importantly by the pipeline of young people they have coming into their population. So the developed world is, you know, well below fertility rate, but China by law has the one-child policy, so it is aging more rapidly than other places.
And again, I'm speaking with Ted Fishman, author of the books Shock of Grey and China Inc. So I take it then that what happened in Japan is the kind of test case for what you're talking about, what you just talked about in China, where you have, from the consequences of low birth rate and the world's longest life expectancy, now you have phenomena in Japan, like universities are closing because of a lack of students. And, of course, as we know, the Japanese refuse to allow immigrants in. So they basically are in what a lot of people have suggested is a kind of paralysis.
Yeah, or demographic decadence is another way people put it. Hmm. Interestingly, you know, Japan, which is going through this kind of paralysis right now, it will actually have a population about the size that it had before World War I by the end of this century. So shrinking rather rapidly, losing millions of people, tens of millions of people over the course of a century. But Japan, you know, is a kind of bellwether for what happens with this, but it is also a kind of inspiration for other countries. So when we look at China, for example, and the reasons for its prosperity today, it's really modeled a little bit on the inadvertent demographic change in Japan. When Deng Xiaoping was looking around China, he was thinking, oh my God, our families are so big, the state is bankrupt, how are we going to feed and send all those people to school? He saw that the other East Asian economies, which had done well and driven down their birth rates, and he was wondering, well, can we drive down our birth rates and get prosperity? So he reversed the chronology of that, and it actually worked, because one thing that happens is that when families are smaller and the parents are still young enough to work, they pour their family resources into that child. They work very hard to educate them. Japanese families spent enormous amounts on cram schools and private schools. Chinese families stopped having the state pay for their schools. The state no longer did that in large degree, and they poured the family resources into their children. And that's part of China's prosperity equation right now. It went from having no university system, no one could afford it, the state couldn't, people couldn't, now it graduates more university graduates than India and the U.S. put together, because you have parents and grandparents pouring their money into that child.
Again, I'm speaking with Ted Fishman, author of Shock of Grey. Now, this notion that you bring up, though, in Shock of Grey, again, the subtitle, The Aging of the World's Population and How It Pits Young Against Old, Child Against Parent, Worker Against Boss, Company Against Rival, and Nation Against Nation. When you talk about age arbitrage, trading in old employees for younger employees who work cheaper, now we've seen that happen, for example, when the government bailed out Detroit. You've got the older UAW workers, getting good UAW wages and pensions, working alongside younger guys that are getting, you know, comparatively less, shall we say. It leads me to a broader question in terms of pitting young against old here in the United States, and that is we seem to be heading in the opposite direction of having older people, retire earlier and then free up jobs for younger workers. What's just happened in France and what's going to be happening here in the United States with all of this talk about, in quotes, reforming Social Security. will mean the exact opposite, and we'll have older workers who expected to work longer and retire later with less.
Yeah, this is fascinating. You know, one of the things I learned in Japan, which I began to notice everywhere I reported the story, was that the Japanese people who retired often in this aging economy retired both with far less money than they thought would take them through to their death, and they retired when they were very capable of working. So because there's a dearth of youth in Japan, employers turned to the older workers, rehired them, but rehired them for half the price. And so I started reporting this around the U.S. and around Europe, too. And one thing you notice about the aging workforce around the world is it demands to work longer because it needs the money. In fact, just touring around on my book and talking to audiences, one of the great fears I hear everywhere is that people will outlive their money. So people feel the need to work longer, but the invested pool of capital in the world that employs people does not want older employees at full wage. They will re-employ them after they leave the workforce or are forced from the workforce and take them back for 20 to 50% less of their pay. So if you look in the United States right now, one of the really sad things is the high unemployment among the worker who is 50 and above. It's the highest it's been in history, higher than it was in the Depression. The job search time is the longest it's ever been, nearly a year. And when those workers re-enter the workplace, they are desperate for work, desperate for money. They come back in for wage reductions that are severe, as I said, between one-fifth and one-half less than they were making in their full-time, full-benefited job.
But the United States has a demographic difference, surely, to Japan in the sense that we have the biggest growing group of young are with the minorities, African American and Latinos, and then the old white people are becoming a minority. And many observers think that that's a part of the subtext of the Tea Party, is this fear of holding on to what they have. And I mean, we have the potential for not just pitting old against young, but pitting all whites against young minorities.
Well, I think that's happening in a very interesting way. So one of the places I profiled was Rockford, Illinois. I talked to hundreds of people in Rockford. And what you find there is that these industrial Midwestern towns are the most vulnerable to globalization, and that makes the older worker the most vulnerable. So when those older workers lose their industrial jobs, they're put into the so-called low-value economy, you know, where they're working at big box stores, working park district jobs, working at jobs that did not pay them what their industrial jobs paid. And that pits them against not only the foreign worker, but as you say, it pits them against the young workers. In a place like Rockford, those young workers do tend to be minorities. But I don't want to minimize the demographic change that's happening in the United States. The workforce in the U.S. is going to go up by around 16 million by mid-century, and the only group, the only age group that's going to be growing is the over 50 age group of workers. You know, even though we are younger than Europe, we still have an aging dynamic, which is very, very powerful in our country.
Well, one of the things I find extraordinary, Ted Fishman, about these arguments about the sudden discovery of deficits and all of these deficit hawks and going after, of all things, Social Security, which is actually something that does pay for itself and is going to be stable for another decade or so, that is, you know, what do the people like Peterson want? I mean, if it weren't for Social Security, the boomers in the last couple of decades would have bankrupted themselves taking care of their elderly parents, right?
Yeah, I don't think Social Security is the big fear of people like Peterson. It's the health care costs and the age related expenditures in the health care system.
Well, what's happening?
Well, the reason they don't fear about Social Security is because the fix is rather easy.
I understand that part, but it's become a political football, you have to admit.
Yeah, oh yeah, it has. But even the Tea Party people don't even want to touch that one.
I see. I see. You think this is going to go away, all this phobia
about
Social Security?
Well, you know, we are living 30 years longer than we did in the first decade of the 20th century. So, you know, it's just a fact that people cannot expect to be idled for 30 years. So if you can get people to pay into Social Security just for a few more years when they're still able and probably want to work, you can really put all fears aside on Social Security.
But wouldn't it make more sense, though, to give people the option of retiring early as long as they had a certain amount of security and to free up the jobs for the younger people?
You know, one miracle about the job market is very often the more jobs there are, the more jobs that are created. So if you allow people to be creative in their late career and still produce and thinking about, you know, staying charged, and we have the moral leadership to say you're a productive citizen, you're a contributing citizen, then it might be that group of older, more experienced workers who are making the jobs, not taking the jobs. So not only are they filling jobs for themselves, but they're creating jobs. The most active group of entrepreneurs in the United States for about the last decade has been the 50-plus group, and often they're entrepreneurs by necessity because they can't get a job, but they end up creating a small business and often hiring people.
But you also said earlier that this is also a lot of tragedy in this group. People are unemployed in a disproportionate and growing numbers.
Yeah, that's right. And that's because we have two kinds of workforces in this country. We have a very large workforce which expects its skills to be obsoleted, and it's being told that its skills are obsolete, especially at the salary they paid. And then we have another part of the workforce which benefits from the knowledge economy, and these are older workers who skills accrue over time so that when they are in their late career, they're more valuable than they've ever been before. You know, what we really need to do as the economy goes forward is give people the tools so that when they get to late career, they are not vulnerable to being devalued in the workforce and going into this low-value workforce, but employers can look at them and say, your skills are great, your judgment is great, your management abilities are great, you're valuable to us.
Well, we've run out of time, effectively, and I wanted to talk about the interesting statistic that 5% of Ecuador lives in Spain, and that by 2050, Spain will have the highest proportion of people over 65 than any other nation in the world. There's so many interesting, so much interesting material in your book, Shock of Grey. I thank you so much for joining us here today, Ted Fishman.
I enjoyed our conversation. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I was speaking with Ted Fishman, author of Shock of Grey and also of China Incorporated. And obviously, I should have asked Ted about China since the Chinese president is meeting here, and they had a total screw-up today where the most technologically advanced country in the world couldn't provide simultaneous translation. We'll talk about that tomorrow. Again, I was speaking with Ted Fishman, author of Shock of Grey, The Aging of the World's Population, How It Pits Young Against Old, Child Against Parent, Worker Against Boss, Company Against Rival, and Nation Against Nation. He also wrote China, Inc. And this has been Background Briefing. You've been listening. You may listen to our archives and contact me at ianmasters.com. You can find us on Facebook at Ian Masters Media. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing, engineer Devin Jordan. I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 for another Background Briefing. Until then, bye.